sounds like Jordan's got a full house today.
Practically. I think the only person that we're missing that we usually have is Wendy Seltzer.
And Tim Rose, I guess.
And Tim Rose, yes.
So do we have someone from the BC on the line here?
Yes, we have Marilyn.
Oh, Marilyn. Excellent. Well, why don't we, given that strong showing, why don't we go ahead and start talking about the agenda? We had left off last time, midway through our discussion of the consequences of removing various data fields. I think we're relatively near the end of that, but I'd like to pick up where we left off in terms of the discussion of merging the, not merging, but replacing the admin and technical contacts with the operational point of contact. And Ross had proposed, or someone had proposed, I know it was Ross, Ross had proposed changing or adding a requirement that registrars must allow registrants to specify up to operational points of contact. Just wanted to talk through that a little bit more and make sure we weren't missing any other points that people had been hoping to make on that particular area. And secondly, then to pick up with the remaining consequences, which I think really what we would be looking at is just looking at the consequences of removing data displayed at the registry level. And then beyond that, the other thing that we talked about on last week's call was, or that I mentioned on last week's call, is that we've had a little bit of discussion around what exactly the OPOC is supposed to do, and there's perhaps still some vagueness around that, so I'd like to revisit that discussion, including I think Kathy had suggested on the last call that it might be she might like to see requirements of the OPOC forward certain types of documents onto the registrants, and maybe exploring some conversation around whether introducing such a requirement would be helpful overall to this framework. And that's essentially all I have for the agenda today. Is there anything else anyone else would like to discuss?
Jordan, it's Marilyn. I'd like to, at some point, as we go through this, have a discussion about how the task force would propose to document to the registrant any of the requirements that we end up agreeing on. So, you know, would we think that it needs to be a standard explanation? I'm not proposing the solution, but I'd like to have a discussion about how we would foresee educating registrants about the change to an OPOC and educating the general public. If we could just put that on our list at some point, maybe not today, but for the next meeting?
Yeah, I think that probably deserves some extended discussion. So I'd probably suggest that we do try to handle that in a future call, but I'll note that request. It is something that's come up several times in the past, so we should make sure that we address it. Anything else?
Yeah, Jordan, just I'm having a hard time hearing you. There seems to be some sort of wind noise or something on the line. So if you could, I don't know if you can increase your volume somehow, that would be very helpful.
I don't think I can, but I can see if I can move.
Or project more, maybe.
And the rest of us can mute when we're not talking.
Yeah, that's always good.
Yeah,
there's a lot of people on the line. And the way to mute, once again, if you don't have your own mute, Glenn, is to *6. Is that it?
That's right, Jordan. That's *6.
If you're not planning on talking soon, if you hit *6, then everyone will appreciate it. Okay, so let's dive right in then, assuming no one else is proposing. And we actually are, as Ross pointed out, we are getting quite a bit of wind noise. So if you can mute, that would be great. I don't know who it is. We never do. Okay, so as we discussed on the last call, we had been talking through the consequences of replacing the administrative and technical contact with the new operational point of contact. One concern that Marilyn had raised was that some companies like to have more than one contact for different things. And Ross had proposed, in order to sort of maintain the status quo in terms of number of contacts, to add a new requirement that's been documented in the online version of the OPOC proposal, that the that the registrars be required to allow to provide a mechanism for the registrant to provide up to two operational points of contact if they wanted to provide it. And I know there's been a little bit of discussion on that on the list, but I wanted to ask maybe Marilyn or others who had thoughts about this, whether this addressed at least that one concern that you had identified on last week's call.
Sure, and I'm going to be on mute for most of the time, so pardon me if I'm a little late getting back on and off. I think it does. Thanks, Ross, for the quick turnaround on the drafting. This would, for instance, allow a multinational corporation who has separate teams for dealing with network attacks, et cetera, and a separate team for dealing with other kinds of trademark and infringement to have separate points of contact. That way they don't have to reorganize internally, and they're able to ensure that the relevant OPOC is contacted, that their information is available, and they're contacted more quickly.
Great. I'm glad we were able to address that concern. The other concern that had been raised was, I think, an issue of there was still an issue of timeliness and whether the there was some delay might be caused by going through an operational point of contact as opposed to direct contact. So I don't think we've necessarily addressed that, although some people had opinions about that in the last call. But are there any other we sort of were running out of time during this portion of the discussion, so I wanted to make sure that there were no other consequences that that people or concerns that people had about this change that we haven't yet captured as part of our discussion.
So, Jordan, we're going to discuss the timeliness issue at some other time, right?
Well, I guess I'm saying we're noting it as a concern, but we don't have at this point. That's all we're doing with these various issues.
Okay.
Is we're noting
okay.
the concern.
Okay. I guess I have a concern as well, and that is the accountability question.
And what can you expand upon that a little?
We're not in any way going to dictate, I don't think, that the OPOC has to be an employee of the registrant or have a legal relationship to the registrant. Is that correct?
I think there's no requirement in the current draft.
Right.
I wouldn't speculate about what we might do.
A third party who has no legal relationship to a registrant may have difficulty themselves in getting a response when they contact a registrant.
I would say, Marilyn, sorry to interrupt, but I think that's an implementation question that I'm not sure that we can deal with one way or the other at this early point.
Sure, Ross, but I thought we were identifying concerns.
Yeah, as a concern, yeah, for sure. And I just wanted to, I don't think we have an answer, though, right?
Exactly.
You know, like you and I have a legal relationship right now, whether but it's not really very explicit. But if I do something
exactly.
to violate your rights, then you've got certain recourse around that. So,
right.
I think we need
exactly. But I have a documented relationship with you, and I'm glad this is going out on the MP3, and we'll be in the minutes, and everybody will be very interested, Ross.
Well, we didn't tell them what the relationship was, so we can leave. We can leave that non-specific.
I had two questions that we can come back to later, and that is the issue of delay, which we've already documented, the issue of whether the OPOC has really the ability to elicit a response.
Right. So Marilyn, can I ask, is this concern exist newly as a result of replacing the admin and tech contacts with the OPOC?
Yeah.
Couldn't that same problem happen today?
It's a question. I'm not suggesting it can't be addressed. The use of proxy services
through the development of the proxy services and the agreements that are signed, I gather that these questions are being addressed.
Yeah, I guess I'm not asking. The case of proxy services might actually be more clear, but today there's no requirement for an admin or technical contact that they have some employee relationship with the registrar, right? So I could just list my ISP and not even tell them about it. And it's a technical contact. You know, they wouldn't necessarily know what to do when they receive correspondence about a domain today.
I'm not questioning that, Jordan, and I'm not even saying that we have to address it. You asked what other questions existed.
Yeah, so I guess I'm just trying to identify what's different between the OPOC and the status quo with regard to this particular issue. So I understand the issue, and I'm just trying to figure out if it's a new issue or if it exists today as well and something we need to address more broadly.
I think it exists today as well.
Okay.
Jordan,
I had a question.
Mr. Steve, could I get in the queue?
Yeah, I think I heard Kathy trying to get in the queue first, so I'll go Kathy and then Steve.
Before we leave, I thought we were wrapping up the last issue of the two operational points of contact. And I'm looking at the Rightly document, and Ross, I don't think I see the language that you circulated. Is that because it's still in circulation on the list, or am I missing it?
I'm seeing it. It's under the type of contact published by registrars. It's in the last paragraph after the numbered list.
Okay, I must be seeing an old cache document. Okay.
So registrars must allow registrant to provide a minimum of two, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay, that is not the version I'm looking at. Good, I'm glad it's there. I will find the right version.
But the language hasn't been modified by anyone in the meantime, so it's exactly what we sent out via email.
Terrific, thank you.
Okay, Steve?
Yeah, I was just going to say that some of the points that Marilyn has mentioned about accountability and timeliness and so forth, which I know we're not talking about right now, I agree that they are not issues that result from the elimination of the admin and tech contact. They are issues that arise from the creation of this OPOC, and I think it would make sense for us to address those in the context of the creation of the OPOC.
Sure. So, Steve, I guess, so I'm just trying to... So you're saying that it's fine, it would be a new issue if it arose either from eliminating the admin and tech or from creating the new thing or replacing them, I guess.
Yeah, I think it comes from the new thing. If we're creating some new category, let's define some of these issues that are not well defined in the status quo.
So, but I guess you're saying, but those issues probably exist today, and then because we're creating a new, this operational point of contact, we would want to try to nail them down as part of that
right.
process? Is that what you're saying? Okay.
Yeah.
Great. Okay, any other comments or concerns or consequences regarding replacing the admin and tech contact with the operational point of contact? Okay. We'll move on then. So the last area where data is removed as proposed by the current draft of the operational point of contact proposal is at the registry level as opposed to the registrar level. And this actually only applies to thick registries. So, for example, CommonNet I don't think would be affected by this portion of the proposal, but the proposal is that the registries would publish only a limited set of data very similar to what CommonNet published today, and that would essentially be the name of the registrar, totally lost where this is. Where is this in the... oh, here it is. So the name of the registrar, the identity and name of the registrar, and their IAN ID. So basically a bunch of information about the registrar, including their WIS server. It would also include the name server information and then the status of the name. And I think we had also agreed at our previously that it may not be reflected by the current online document, that it would also include various dates, like the expiration date of the domain name as well. Is that right, Russ?
I believe so, yes.
Yeah, okay.
I think that's fair.
So as a result of that, in any case, there's a bunch of contact data that's published today by the thick registries that essentially mirrors the contact data that's published by the registrars, and that would be removed. And so the only place that you would find this contact data would be at the registrar level. So it's a brief summary of the change, and I guess I'll open the floor up if people have, if there are concerns or consequences about removing this data at the registry level. We had briefly discussed this in Marrakesh, but I wanted to make sure we documented any consequences here as well.
I would just add, Jordan, to that explanation that the one thing that this Rightly document doesn't include that the previous submission did was the one of the underlying goals of this proposal, which was to bring some predictability to the WHOIS service. Right now, we've got different rules for different registrants based on the different registries and registrars that they're dealing with. The same registrant under .name and .com or .net and .biz or .info and .biz are subject to very, very different rules. The notion here was that we would take a look at bring all of the registries in line with where the bulk of registrations were, which was at this time CommonNet. So to the extent that they're a good best practice that everybody would basically follow that same practice.
Speaking for .org, David, we would have no objection. Actually, we would prefer to follow the same pattern here as .com and .net.
Okay. Thanks, David. So that gets a little bit to the rationale, I guess.
Yeah.
What I didn't speak to, but so I'll re-ask my question. Are there any concerns or potential consequences of removing the data at the registry level?
This is Steve. I don't think there's a problem with this in principle, but the concern that's been expressed is to what extent is in practice this registry WHOIS data. A backup in cases where the registrar, for whatever reason, is not providing WHOIS data. So I've asked our folks just to give us a sense, at least anecdotally, of how frequently that occurs, that they can't get WHOIS data from the registrar in a thick registry setting.
Dude, Steve, do you have a sense?
Have to go to the...
I'm sorry, I was interrupting. Go ahead. I apologize.
And how often do they have to go to the registry to get it? We know from the, as one data point in the GAO study, I think they found that about 3% of the time, or 3% of the names, there wasn't any WHOIS data available. And I don't know whether they were just looking at registry. They were looking at ComNet and org. But I think, I don't know to what extent they were, perhaps that's a surrogate for how often registrar WHOIS data is not available. And in those cases, when they occur in a thick registry setting, then the backup would be the registry data. But I think we need to find out a little bit more about how often this problem occurs, but at least I think we can expect there will be some circumstances in which registrar WHOIS data is not available.
Steve, do you have a sense of the number of registrars that are not providing WHOIS?
Well, no, I don't. I don't think that there are, but again, the GAO study said 3% of the time they could locate WHOIS data. Now, that could just be some transient thing where it was down for some period of time, or it could be a circumstance where the registrar is simply not providing the data. I assume that all the larger registrars, this is not an issue.
Is there any support staff on the call? Other than anybody from the policy group, is Liz or Denise on the call?
Or Maria, maybe?
Maria.
Maria's on, I think.
I thought I heard her on earlier.
It would be very helpful. It would be very helpful if the task force was provided with a list of accredited registrars and their corresponding WHOIS servers. Because then we could very easily check that, Steve, and I think that that's a very important point. My preference would be to make very strong recommendations to staff that they go after these registrars that aren't living up to the contract. We've already got policy to deal with this stuff, right?
Hey, Ross?
Yeah.
Would you, it's Marilyn for the record. It seems to me that the other part of this request really ought to be to ask the operational staff who are supposed, you know, they're supposed to be tracking the uniform who is supporting complaint form to update us on the when they are getting complaints of know who is data.
Right.
So we might marry those two requests. If you would accept that as a friendly amendment.
I think that's a good idea. So,
yeah.
Hold on one second. So we want to ask how get a list of the registrars and their corresponding to servers and ask them investigation of how often there are complaints to know who is data through the who is problem data problem reporting system.
Yeah, my request was slightly different, Jordan, because I think we do have an authoritative, definitive list of every registrar and their corresponding WHOIS server.
Right, I said that as the first.
Oh, did you? Okay, sorry, I missed that. I was trying to mute my line, and Star 6 doesn't seem to be working, so I was not paying attention as a result.
Two separate requests. One to get a list of registrars and their corresponding WHOIS servers, and the other to ask about the results of any WHOIS problem, WHOIS data report.
And I had a little amendment to that request as well, Jordan. That's why I was interrupting.
Okay. Me too, Ken.
Yeah. My suggestion also might be that it would not be a bad idea for staff to provide us with some sort of an idea as to what kind of steps they take and how often do they check to authenticate whether or not the registrars are providing the appropriate WHOIS service. Do they have a procedure like quarterly? Do they spider these the servers and so forth, or maybe that's something just wouldn't be relevant to us, but I'd sure like to know how often they're checking up on these guys.
Right, and if they're not, can they hire Ben Edelman to do it?
No, but I mean, I don't know how old that report is that we keep referring to. I think that report was prepared about 3 years ago, and I just don't know how relevant the statistics are. You know, 3% when? 3 years ago?
It would definitely be good to have more data. Kathy, what was your proposal?
Yeah, I don't know. It seems like we're making two very different types of requests of staff, and one seems very defined, and one I fear is maybe almost undefinable. I support Russ's recommendation that we, and it seems very definitive, that we can get a list of accredited registrars and the definitive WHOIS servers and kind of look and see if they're available. That seems like a defined task. But to go after the 3%, if it is that, of WHOIS entries which don't exist or don't have sufficient information, seems to me a little odd because that's exactly the problem we're trying to solve here. We know that there are people. I mean, there are registrants. There's no kind of, I mean, I'm not quite sure why we're investigating or what we're looking for here. Is this a registrar problem, a registrant problem?
It could well be
a registrant problem, and if it is, it may be a privacy issue, which is exactly what we're here to try to solve. So
my point there, Kathy, was that Steve was raising a compliance issue, not necessarily a WHOIS issue. And then if there are registrars that are non-compliant with their obligations to their contracts to ICANN, that staff should be investigating that and acting upon that and not not requiring us to deal with that or, either explicitly or implicitly requiring us to deal with that through the policy development process. There's processes in place, or should be processes in place, if staff, if the compliance staff are doing their job, to deal with the exact issue that Steve raised. So I would hate for us to go down the road of passing new policy to deal with the with any shortfall in the application of those existing processes. That's all I'm proposing.
And I hope you didn't think that my suggestion implied that, Kathy. I was just trying to find out operationally how they
how they ascertain whether or not their registrars are, in fact, staying in compliance. You know.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to add one thing, Jordan.
A procedure one. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead, Paul.
On the 3%, if 3% didn't respond, you know, I think that study was across, you know, ComNet, org, I believe. So if 3% didn't respond, you know, the ComNet zone file compared to the org zone file are huge. So even if 3% didn't respond, going to the registry for the very small percent of the 3% that are .orgs, I don't think that gives much benefit. In other words, if 3% didn't respond, you can't go to .com and .net to get the info anyway.
So, but Paul, it wasn't didn't respond, I don't think. It was no data.
You still could go to the registry to get it.
Right, you still, yeah, I mean, his point is that even if 3% of the data is not available and you have some sort of backup plan, it might only help you get to, you know, 0.3% of the data and 2.7%.
Right. And do you still have a queue? Because I had a comment.
I don't have a queue right now, so you're...
Well, and my comment was just, I don't even know, and it's Maryland for the record, I don't even know what the right percent of error would be, and I'm not proposing to make a comment on the right percent of error. I think that if we take the steps that were suggested, the combination of the Rader, Cade, Stubbs examination of information, that would help to inform our dialogue in any case.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think, to Kathy's point, I think there's two sort of distinct problems here. One relates to registrant provided data and sort of what shows up when data shows up. And that's what we've been talking about for a while. And the second problem is one specific where the registrar returns no response at all, essentially, for a request. And that could be due to error. It could be due to the registrar just deciding they don't want to spend money on setting up a Whois server. It could be because it's temporarily unavailable, or who knows why. But that's, I think, a different case than when some data shows up, but it's not necessarily what some people might consider the right data. Okay, so Steve, we've noted that concern, and I think we have a bunch of action items hoping to. It does seem mostly like a compliance issue with regards to the existing policy.
Yeah, I would agree with Ross's characterization of it, and what you said about the distinction between that situation and the one Kathy was talking about.
Okay, are there any other concerns or consequences of removing this registry data? Okay, so I think we've captured those. Oh, go ahead. Is that Ross?
Yeah, it's me. I just wanted to note the one of the statements that we had in the other considerations portion of the original proposal was that this really, from a transfers perspective, places a bigger onus on the adoption of EPP, and there's certain risks around that not becoming widespread that at this point I think are relatively minimal. Certainly a lot less so than when the proposal was written, but it really helps to, from that perspective, I would echo Steve's concerns around the availability of Whois data to facilitate transfers and EPP data to facilitate transfers. So there are risks there.
Okay, so it's probably worth documenting that as well. I think, isn't there some language that there would, even if this data was... Well, I guess it doesn't necessarily relate to the registries in particular, but some special data would be made available to registrars to facilitate transfers if EPP wasn't in place.
Yeah, I don't remember what the original statement was, but...
Okay, Russ, if you think there's... the other thing you may want to do, if you think there's sort of rationale or things missing from the current draft, from the sort of overview statement originally, it may be worth, you know, editing the online document to get those incorporated for people that are coming to this for the first time.
Sure.
Okay, great. So what we'll do is I will try to capture all of these consequences in a list, and I'll send them around, and maybe I'll ask Maria to help me out with this to make sure I haven't missed anything. But I've been trying to take note of the consequences and concerns that have been raised during these last two calls for each of these areas, and I will get them sent out to the list so to make sure that we've captured everything, and so we'll have these documented as we go through the rest of our work and decide what feasible next steps are. I think perhaps in making sure that we're addressing some of these concerns, particularly if they're we consider them compatible with the overall purpose of the quiz, for some reason we're not doing a good job of meeting that. I want to, but before we, so once I send it out, well, I think we'll have some opportunity to develop some steps there. So I want to change focus now to a discussion of what the OPOC is supposed to be doing exactly. This is something that came up on our last call. I think that there were a number of places where Steve and maybe Marilyn had suggested that it's a little hard to figure out what the consequences of some of the changes were without knowing exactly what the scope of the OPOC's role was supposed to be. Secondarily to that, I think Kathy had proposed on the last call that it might make sense for the OPOC to be responsible for delivering certain, like she gave the example of cease and desist letters to the registrant. And there's no sort of affirmative burden like that in the existing draft, so I wanted to maybe start talking through that idea as an example of whether it makes sense to include additional requirements like that and what they should be, and more generally talking about the scope of the operational point of contact. I will add the one thing that the language that we have in the current draft regarding what the OPOC does is that it says the purpose of the operational point of contact is to resolve or to reliably pass on data to resolve operational issues relating to a domain name. At a minimum, this must include the resolution of issues relating to the configuration of records associated with the domain name within a DNS server. And then it says the operational contact may also be capable of resolving additional types of issues based on an agreement with the registered name holder to do so. So today, if the registrant wanted to have the OPOC do additional stuff for them, like pass on additional types of correspondence, they could ask the OPOC to do so, but it wouldn't necessarily be required by the current draft. I'll suggest why don't we take up perhaps just using as a starting point, Kathy's. I don't want to make it into a proposal, Kathy, but you had briefly suggested this, and I want to. It seems like it might be a useful starting point for some dialogue on this point. So you had suggested, I think, on the last call, that it might be useful for the operational point of contact to pass on. You gave the example of cease and desist letters. Could you maybe speak? Is there maybe some rationale or some broader sort of responsibility here that you think might be reasonable?
Sure. Thanks. And I know that we're talking here about something that does not currently exist. But I and the word I used last time was template. And the question is whether it's possible to create a template, a model of very important correspondence, and everybody's going to have a different definition of that registrants would probably want to receive, and that the person sending would probably want them to receive. Cease and desist letters would be one. Something rising to a legal issue is probably the general category. Not marketing letters, certainly not letters from other registrars trying to sell services, but something rising to an issue, and a legal issue involving the domain name. And there are some Network Solutions private registration, for example, does agree to pass on letters that are certified. Not regular first class, not bulk mail, but certified letters. So I was thinking about that. I've also spent a lot of time talking with people since in the 2 weeks, and I know that there's a lot of concern about this proposal, and so I want to share that as well, that whatever template we create, it creates a model for other people to, you know, they're legitimate users of it, and then there will be abusers of it. And that it does create some liability, certainly for the registrars, that if they don't, if something gets dropped by mistake, there's a problem. So I now see a lot clearer than 2 weeks ago both sides of the equation on this. But if you want to bring it up again, that was the reasoning of it, was to create some template that I had been envisioning, you know, good users would use to try to pass on some kind of notice. But again, I can definitely see the potential for abuse of this now.
Okay, great. So, any other thoughts about this? I have a couple, but I'll maybe hold off until other people have a chance to chime in. Whether this is a good change or not good to the overall proposal.
This is Steve. Kathy, one thing you said I wasn't clear on about liability for the registrar, would that be, I'm not sure where that would enter in, are you talking about liability for the OPOC or something that the registrar would be exposed to?
I guess I envision registrars and ISPs acting as OPOCs for individuals. So you're right. You're right to clarify that. Yeah, I think there would be some liability for the OPOC. That we would be imposing, that's a new type of liability, one they don't have today.
Under the proposal or under the requirement to forward documents?
Under the requirement to forward documents.
Under Kathy's amendment, I agree. I don't know if we want to call it Kathy's amendment, under this theoretical amendment.
Well, the proposal already says reliably, the purpose of the operational point of contact is to resolve or to reliably pass on data to resolve. We have to get to the object of that sentence, but so the expectation anyway under the proposal as it now stands is that some things would get passed on, and I think the concern you're raising, Kathy, is what happens if it doesn't? Who's responsible for that?
Or if we create a category of information to be passed on that is beyond the scope of the purpose, are we, you know, almost, are we increasing the liability? Are we increasing the potential for things to be dropped? It's one thing to say that the OPOC will reliably pass on data issues related to the configuration of the records associated with the domain name. It may be another thing entirely to say that they'll pass on perhaps all certified mail or all, you know, first-class mail.
Did you understand me?
Yeah, go ahead, Russ.
Yeah, I don't think it's appropriate to put the burden on the point of contact in any event. You know, this is, at the end of the day, an agreement with the registrants. The registrants have obligations. They have obligations to follow the law, abide by their registrant agreements, make sure the data is accurate, blah, 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 blah. To move this off to the point of contact, I think, is just adding an additional layer of complexity that is probably not warranted. At the end of the day, if the registrant isn't living up to their obligations under their agreements because of the actions of one of their contacts, you know, that's a problem that the registrant has full control to resolve and need resolve if they're going to live up to their obligations under law and under contract. So, you know, I'm not sure that we need to reinvent the wheel here and start spreading the blame around to the degree that I think Kathy's proposal might.
Yeah, so I've thought about this a little bit, and I'm actually not 100% sure how it would even be possible to impose this obligation on the OPOC per se, in that the OPOC's probably not a contracting party with ICANN or the registrar or the registry. They're probably contracting somehow, if they do at all, with the registrant themselves. And so it's not immediately obvious how that even using ICANN sort of contractual framework, we would somehow bind the OPOC doing something, short of, I guess we could include language saying, registrant, if you sign up an OPOC, then you have to make sure that they do X, Y, and Z, and if they don't, you know, include this provision in your contract with them, and if, you know, include some sort of liability or something like that. But it seems like that would make it much more difficult for registrants to find OPOCs that were, it would certainly narrow the available choices for OPOCs if it had to include, and the ability to easily add one if it had to include some sort of tie-in back to the ICANN contractual framework.
Jordan, can I come up?
Yeah, go ahead.
Actually, I wonder if, based on what you just said and what I'm, you know, the issues that are being raised, whether we can continue this discussion under what Marilyn raised earlier, the education, when we go back to how are we going to educate the registrants. Because as a registrant, I would certainly want, I believe I'd be looking for an OPAC who would pass on Steve's cease and desist letter, because I'd like to know it. And if we draft language or advise language that would include some kind of notice, just like you were talking about, Jordan, to registrants that they may want to seek an OPAC who by contract will pass on this data, we may be serving the same goal but through a different door. Letting people know it's an issue.
Yeah, can I ask a question, a related question?
Yeah, go ahead.
So, hypothetically, let's take MCAID.net as an example. If I chose an OPAC that did not have the requirement to pass on information to me, and I, someone who had a more legitimate claim to that name, hard to believe, but someone had a more legitimate claim to that name, attempted to contact me. The information was not passed on. I failed to respond, say, to legal service, et cetera, and then found myself in court being sued for infringement, et cetera. Where's the liability? Is it me because I didn't respond, the OPAC because they didn't pass it on, the registrar because they... I'm just trying to figure out what happens if the information is not passed to the registrar, if it's legal and if it involves legal risk.
Yeah, this is probably a question for the for the lawyers among us, Marilyn.
Yeah. This is Steve. Can I?
Yeah, go ahead.
And then I'll join.
I think you're right that this question is going to vary under different legal systems and under different facts, and just because this policy says the OPAC can do certain things, that doesn't necessarily make it so or make it binding on a court later on. And the thing that troubles me here is that we're talking in this proposal about taking away a way of contacting the registrant in that circumstance. We might be taking away several ways of contacting the registrant in that circumstance, but we know the proposal is to take away the mailing address of the registrant. You know, the admin and tech contact might also be ways to contact the registrant, but those would be replaced by the OPAC. So if we're reducing one channel or constricting one channel of contacting the registrant, then what are we opening up? What expectations should we have about this other channel? And how should those be embodied? Should it be something that the registrant takes on the responsibility for? Is it something that the registrar is empowered to enact, to act on? For example, take that circumstance that Marilyn talked about, and somebody sends this cease and desist letter, or whatever it is, and the OPAC doesn't pass it along. Is that a basis then for the registrar to do something the way they might do today in the case of a proxy registration? Is this something where they could put a registration on hold if the OPAC system breaks down? Because again, the OPAC is supposed to, his purpose is to reliably pass on data to resolve these issues.
I think it does, Steve. I think, you know, under the current system, if we look at that as a an example for practice, we receive a complaint about a registration that has inaccurate WHOIS data. Our first point of contact is to try the registrant via email. We don't have their email address on record, so we use the admin contact as a proxy for that. If we don't receive a response back within a certain period of time, and we're unable to contact them via the postal mail address of the admin contact, our third resort is to try the postal contact of the registrant. But if those each fail, then the registrant loses their address. Now, in a lot of cases, the admin contact will have provided us with that information in the first place, not necessarily the registrant, especially in the cases of corporations where the corporation is not, where the registrant is not an individual but a legal entity. The registrant will lose their address in those cases, and I think that is a fair practice to continue with, and I think it's a reasonable expectation to set for registrants that if their contact points aren't living up to the requirements of the registration, then they better get more competent or more reliable contact points to deal with the needs of the registration.
Ross,
yeah.
I couldn't agree with you more, but maybe I'll just save my comment for the discussion under awareness and education and merely note that we failed miserably on awareness and education in relation to the more than three-letter string name, so it probably deserves more attention if we make this kind of change so that people are fully informed about what actions they need to take.
Yeah, your point is well taken. I think that's a very separate and different set of circumstances, but your point around the need for education and awareness is certainly well taken.
Yeah, I still have Kathy in the queue.
Yeah, no, I agree with Marilyn completely about awareness and education. I think Ross makes a good point that there are other avenues, that the OPAC will have its specific purpose under the ICANN, under the GNSO Council definition, if it's adopted by the board, but that there are these other paths that attorneys can contact. They may be contacting the OPAC directly, not in its role as OPAC, but perhaps in its role as the ISP or the registrar, or going to the registrars directly, or going to the registries directly. There are a lot of ways to contact the registrant, and since this information is likely to be more accurate, there may be an additional hurdle, but in the end, you may wind up reaching the registrant more quickly. I don't know if that makes sense.
Well, I don't know those are way. I wouldn't think of contacting the registrar as a way of contacting the registrant. It may be a way of trying to get the immediate problem resolved, but it sounds like, you know, if we can resolve these issues without involving the registrar, we would prefer to do that. And many issues are resolved without involving the registrar because we're able to contact the registrant. Now, if we have less of an ability to contact the registrant, can we do something in the OPAC channel to try to enhance that, or at least to give very strong incentives for people to structure this in a way so that we can contact the registrar?
Right. So, Steve, actually, do you have any ideas along those lines of how we might improve the process to give either the right incentives or the right structure to enable...
Well, I think the more detail we can put in here about what the expectations are, the better, and I think education is going to be part of it, too. But maybe some... And there's some consequences for failure of this system that are kind of outside the scope of what we're talking about, like are you in default if a lawsuit is filed? That's not an issue that this group can resolve for every legal system, but there may be some other consequences with regard to, you know, suspension of the registration or something like that that are within the scope of what we can resolve.
So I see the consequence there. What would that consequence be tied to? Like, how do you imagine, you know, if X happens, then your registration is suspended. What would X be?
Well, it could be if the OPAC fails to pass along the data to resolve these issues. I mean, I'm not disagreeing with the idea that we might have somewhat more detailed discussion of what those types of issues are, but you know, what are the consequences if the system doesn't work?
Consequences for whom, Steve?
It spell out. Well, it could be consequences for the registrant. Certainly, I think Ross, your point was correct that. I'm not sure who has a contractual relationship with the OPAC. Now, the OPAC might be the registrar, but I think we have to assume it isn't always going to be the registrar. It might be some third party. And I'm not sure what consequences we can really impose in this context on that person. So I suppose it would come back to the registrant.
isn't it like how it is today? I mean, if, let's say, you know, there's a domain name and it's AT&T, and there's some employee at AT&T that's the, you know, listed as the admin contact. Domain is owned by AT&T. AT&T is the registrant, but the contact within AT&T is some AT&T employee. Just because AT&T corporate doesn't get the message from some lawyer that they're, you know, violating some trademark, they're still violating it. Just because the employee of AT&T didn't give the message to AT&T corporate, the liability is still with AT&T, isn't it?
Yeah, but under
employee.
No, I agree with that, Paul, but I think that under the status quo, we have a, especially for if the registrant is AT&T, we have a pretty reliable way of invoking the process that will lead to that imposition of liability, because we have the mailing address of the registrant at a minimum, and we also may have other information from the admin and tech contact that will help us to reach the registrant. If those go
I hear
away,
you, but what happens then, now when you can't contact the registrant? When you can't contact the registrant and you file a UDRP, you win, because the registrant doesn't show up to the hearing or the adjudication of the dispute. So wouldn't you just win, just like today?
Yeah, but the problem is that's the tip of the iceberg. For every issue that's resolved through a UDRP, there are 1,000 that are resolved without the UDRP. There are hundreds that are resolved without going to the registrar at all. They all depend on contacting the registrant. So
we're reducing our
ability to contact the registrant. What are we substituting for that will help us to resolve these issues?
Yeah, I don't see it as reducing your ability. I see it as enhancing it.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
I see it as enhancing it, not reducing it.
Well, it only enhances it if the OPOC does his or her job. And if the OPOC does his or her job, which we haven't really defined yet, fine. But what if the OPOC does? We know that some OPOCs won't do their job.
And purposely so, which I think is also reflective of the existing situation where we've got bad actors in the system that refuse to do the right thing and have printed inaccurate data. And, so I think it's largely that same subset that we can count on their continued bad behavior.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like there's probably not a huge amount of difference between someone telling their OPOC to just throw away all legal notices and shred them and telling your secretary to shred all legal notices. They receive them. Either way, you're not going to. The person that has no interest in dealing with any of that stuff and just tells everyone to get rid of them all, probably not going to see them one way or the other. So I guess the question is, are we introducing somehow, for good actors, are we increasing the chance that we might not be able to get them? And it seems like Steve, you're suggesting that maybe there's some ways to create some either structure or incentives around the OPOC to at least improve upon that particular aspect of it. So we don't need to necessarily resolve this at this moment, but I think it would be very helpful to Steve and others if you have ideas about how we can improve the OPOC sort of the incentive system or the structure so that it's going to make the effective communication with the registrant more reliable. I think that I'm not hearing any opposition from anyone to hearing and considering specific ideas at this point.
Jordan, what's our scheduled time for today? Are we supposed to go till noon or till 11?
We're supposed to be till noon. I'm hoping that we'll be able to wrap up a little bit short of that.
Okay, I have to wrap up now, but thanks to everybody for the productive call.
Hi, Russ. Jordan, can I add a little bit to that of things to think about?
Yeah, go ahead.
And perhaps would the improved accuracy of the data also serve as kind of an independent way of ultimately making it easier to contact registrants? That we probably, under the new system, probably won't have that 3% that just don't exist in the system, if that's the case.
Well, yeah, my guess is actually it's probably a lot more than 3% today that data exists, but it doesn't work.
I think we're mixing apples and oranges there. The 3% is where there's just no whoIS server at all, or no data at all. Then we have inaccurate data. We have a in the hypothesis that data will be more accurate. But again, the data we're talking about at this point, and the way the proposal now stands, is only the name of the registry. So that name is more accurate. It's really John Smith out there who registered the domain name. That doesn't really help me in contacting that person.
Sure, but one improvement you have is that you have more accurate, whereas today the admin and technical, all the data you see could be junk. Under the proposal, you would get at least you would have the operational point of contact, and hopefully you would be.
And you're hypothesizing that that will be more accurate than admin and technical contact. I think it could be.
Well, because we're in,
but
we're,
only if we build in some incentives for it to be.
Well, correct. Well, we've already, to a certain extent, we've already done that. We've introduced some affirmative requirements in the proposal to improve the accuracy of that data.
What are you referring to?
As we discussed,
the last part of the proposal.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Well,
exactly.
We'll,
so you
we'll
know,
talk about that. I think that provides a very marginal increase.
Okay. Right. Well, so you have essentially a guarantee of the email address working, and hopefully a reasonably higher chance, somewhat either marginal or somewhat higher chance of the rest of the data working, whereas today some percentage of all the data doesn't work.
Exactly.
Well, you might be right, but I think I'm not prepared to accept the hypothesis that because we call it an OPOC instead of an ad for tech contact, and because if someone is caught with bad data and supplies new data, then the registrar pings the email address to see if it's a functioning, you know, Hotmail account. I don't think we can assume from that we're going to be, that we will have enhanced contactability, especially when the registrants, the only thing that we have about the registrant is the name.
The only thing publicly, but privately, you will have the address and probably other contact information as well.
It's not going to help me when I need to contact the registrant to try to resolve this problem before it goes to a UDRP, before it goes to court, before I go to law enforcement, before, you know, a lot of things that, you know, in some cases you're going to have to do all those things, but most of these issues are resolved just by contacting registrants.
But it would help you, because if you didn't have that in-between layer, the registrant might put in bad information so that the public doesn't have his information.
Exactly.
So in those cases, it would be in-between.
And instead, the only thing he's putting in that's publicly accessible is his name. It's about him, right?
Correct. That would enhance that. So therefore, the private information he would put in would be accurate.
Right. So I guess at the point that you, so this probably doesn't help for your non-legal challenges, Steve. But I guess at the point you went to actually, you know, subpoena information or something like that, hopefully,
well,
it would be better.
It could help, because you could build in something here that says if you contact the OPOC and you don't get a response back from the registrant within X period of time, then the registrar will give you that private data.
So that private
data is really going to be, if we think that's going to be more accurate, I don't know if it will be or not, but again, that's a consequence if the OPOC system doesn't work. Now, it's opaque. We don't know whether it didn't work because the OPOC threw the thing in the trash or because the OPOC did what he was supposed to do and passed it along to the registrant, and the registrant threw it in the trash.
But, Steve, you're
really
assuming good actors here. You're assuming good actors. What if the OPOC doesn't pass on a fraudulent registrar notice? A domain name expiring. Click here.
Or junk email or whatever.
Yeah.
This is a spam filter. And then it also depends on who's requesting. How do you know the public isn't just requesting every who is? Some bad actor out there. I request every who is, and for anyone that doesn't respond, I get the actual information for.
Exactly. That opens up all the harassment and abuse that the system solves or resolves.
Yes, and besides, what happens to people that are on a vacation and can't answer in time? I mean, there's so many problems around that timely answering issue, you know, that I don't really want to get into things like that. Besides, one thing that should be mentioned, that we're talking about enhancing privacy in this task force. So if you enhance something, something else got to lose. So I don't think that we make the situation worse than the situation is right now. And if there's a contactability of the registrant, that should be good enough, I guess, to do the job you have to do.
So I don't think we actually need to get too deep in the weeds on this particular proposal. I think, Steve, it's probably worth, as I suggested earlier, if there are sort of approaches like this that you think are worthwhile to improve the contactability, I think probably putting together a list of improvements and sharing them on the list would be a great point to start discussion on how we can improve the contactability. And, some people may not like some of them, but maybe we'll find some sort of reasonable consensus that, approaches that we can
use. I agree with that. It seems like if we had a bunch of, various examples of, use cases, that would be really helpful to improve it, to make sure it's, a better thing than what we have now.
Yeah, exactly. So I guess in the use case model, putting on my new engineering hat, I guess, is that, if we were to identify, a few, for each of the concerns or the consequences that we raised, say, here are some things we could do to improve the proposal to address these. I think that's probably a really productive way to try to move this conversation forward. And so I think it's actually, I don't know if that's just an off-the-cuff suggestion, Steve, but that sort of idea of things we can do to sort of create those incentives, I think, are really helpful. So let me ask that maybe we all just think a little bit on that once we get the list of consequences, maybe put together some ideas about how we can address them. In that vein, I want to spend maybe the last little bit of our call, and I do want to wrap up a little bit early, but I want to talk about the meta point that we've been sort of talking around, which is what the OPOX, just more generally, what the OPOX responsibilities might be. And, I mentioned the definition that we have currently earlier, and I guess it seems like perhaps there's still some confusion with the current definition relating to operational point of contact, or maybe what I'm getting, I don't know, Steve or others, if the concern is actually that you understand perfectly well what the current definition means and you're just still not happy with the scope of what's encompassed by the OPOC, but it's come up a few times, just sort of this notion of what the OPOC is supposed to be responsible for. So Steve, can I start off, you've mentioned this a couple of times, so can I start off just by asking whether you're confused by the current definition or whether you aren't confused and just don't like it?
Well, prior to Marrakesh, I was less confused than I am now, but now I've been told by the chairman of the GNSO Council that issues relating to the configuration of records associated with the domain name within a DNS name server includes, for example, having copyright infringing material on a website to which the domain name resolves. That falls within that definition. If that's the case, then I look at this a lot differently than I did when I thought that really, that case wasn't covered by that phrase. And since the proposal says at a minimum, this must include, this phrase, operational issues related to a domain name. What does that mean? At a minimum, it means resolution of issues related to the configuration of the records associated with the domain name within a DNS name server. So I guess I'd ask the question, does that include the presence of copyright infringing material on a website to which the domain name resolves? Is that an issue that's described by that phrase?
Yeah, I think if someone...
I thought I heard Bruce Tonkin say it was.
Yeah, but that's just Bruce.
Yeah, so... maybe I'll make a couple comments about that. But if someone just joined...
This is Aubrey. I fell off and came back.
Yeah, so you added... When you came on, a lot of buzz got added to the call. So maybe if you could try to mute, that might help the rest of us. Perfect. So I guess, Steve, that's probably not... That is just Bruce, and I think that view has not been adopted by the council necessarily. but it's certainly an interesting view. My interpretation of Bruce's comments, I'll add, is that Bruce said that essentially if there are issues relating to, for example, copyright infringement of a on a website, one of the possible remedies to that issue would be to turn off the DNS for a domain. And so that remedy itself is related to the configuration of the records in the name server. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the content itself is part of the records on the DNS server. Does that make sense at all? So the way of resolving it is within scope, but the actual problem is not.
I think that position makes sense to me, but again, I don't think that's what some... That's not the way some people have interpreted this.
Interpreted by this, you mean Bruce's comments, or by this you mean the...
That phrase, issues relating to the configuration of the records associated with the domain name within the DNS. But I tend to agree with you. I think you can reconfigure the records that would help to solve in a way that would help to solve the problem, but that doesn't mean it's I don't know whether that means it comes within that phrase or not. I think there is a state of confusion here because I thought we had a fairly clear understanding of what this meant, and then a lot of people said, "Oh no, you're wrong. You're jumping to conclusions. You're misleading people by saying this is only to resolve technical issues." So we have we had a lot of discussion about this at Marrakesh, and people who voted for it were going to be asked to explain what they thought it meant. And I don't know quite where that stands right now. But I think it's hard to give an answer to your question's a very fair one, but I don't think it's hard to give an answer to it because I think there's still a lot of confusion over what this means.
Right. Okay. So I guess to my original question,
from the proponents,
there is confusion at this. So there is confusion at this point, as opposed to not necessarily you don't like it, but at this point you don't even know what it means.
Right. This is Albert. Can I say something?
Yeah, go ahead, Albert.
I think that you know there are two extreme ways of understanding it. I think the just technical was indeed one of the extreme. I think that the interpretation that people like Gack got out of it, that this means that it's basically the status quo and everything is like it is now, is also an extreme. I think that when one starts thinking about the technical and operational uses for which the record is put, it does put it into a more limited than the status quo, but still not the, well, just technical, just to change the address. I mean... So it does have a nuanced understanding, and as I try to argue in Marrakesh, everything has a nuanced understanding. But it is somewhere in between the two extremes, the sort of everything that GAC and intellectual property police would want versus, you know, just the technology that people like me would actually want. And that's why when I voted for it, I actually said, this doesn't go far enough because it isn't just technical.
So I guess we have a problem here. I guess one approach we could take is that because there's some vagueness here and it looks like the council itself is taking some measures to try to address concerns about perception of this by getting statements about what people think it means or whatever. I guess one approach we could take would be to take a lead from the council as to what they think it's supposed to mean. And another approach we could take is perhaps to try to do some further clarification work within the task force itself. I don't know, maybe some of the council members on the call can give us a sense for whether they think it's likely the council is going to provide some relatively authoritative guidance on this point or not.
I would say that the council is divided on whether they're going to provide authoritative guidance.
So we wouldn't conclude that it was likely in that case.
I wouldn't. We are going to have a further consultation with the GAC in São Paulo on who is, and we are expecting principles from the GAC on both who is and on GTLD policy in that time frame, if not before. Because of that, as a counselor, I would expect to have to nail this discussion down further, but I'm not going to tell you that I think there's unanimity among the counselors. There are other counselors on the call who should speak for themselves. And when I say unanimity, I mean on the need to be clearer. Sorry.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe, Avery, do you have any thoughts on that? Because, you basically said there's this, it's not as clear as you might initially
think. No. I think it is fairly clear.
Okay.
I think, like, in every definition, there are nuances. We all read it the way we want to. And I don't believe that there's anything the council can do to make it clearer. So I would tend to sort of say, as I say, I don't think it interprets into just technical, because obviously operational is included. You know, I don't think it turns into status quo either, because it is different from Proposition 2, which was essentially status quo or even status quo plus. So I think that it did define a middle position. Middle positions are always nuanced because, you know, as I say, people read into it their extremes. And I don't see us doing anything other than what the proposition that was accepted was, which is most of us will write voluntarily something to explain what we thought it meant. And then once we get back everything, you know, the extra consultations with everyone, the work that this group does, then we'll, you know, go through and see whether we need to tighten up the definition, et cetera, before finalizing things. I don't expect us to give any more clarity. I think even if we came out with another proposition, this is what it means, by the time we finished discussing it, it would be full of words with nuance.
Okay, thanks. I think under those circumstances, it might be reasonable for us to perhaps maybe not try to figure out what a reasonable interpretation or new proposition is, but at the very least to identify things that we think it would be reasonable that might be encompassed, some sort of propositions that we might think it would be reasonable that this would be encompassed by the role of the operational point of contact. And if we included that along with the proposal, it might provide some clarity for people reading it, as at least what the task force views the purpose of this contact to be.
Good idea.
So I'd ask maybe in that vein, and hopefully trying to be somewhat effective working offline, that people might propose some reasonable things that the operational point of contact might be responsible for, and we can have some discussion around whether or not the task force agrees that those are reasonable responsibilities. Under whatever reading of the definition of purpose that you care to adopt for the purpose of advancing this reasonable responsibility. So I think probably, unless other people have comments at this point, it's probably worth wrapping up. We're left with two little bits of homework. One is to suggest specific improvements that we might make to the proposal. And we talked a lot today about improving contactability through either structure or incentives. But generally speaking, if there are consequences that have been identified that are bad and you think that there's a way to improve the proposal to address them, I think sending those out would be very helpful. And then the other bit of homework is if people have ideas of responsibilities that we think are reasonable that the operational point of contact might have, advancing those to the list as well. And hopefully we can pick up some of that discussion on our next call, which will be in 2 weeks from yesterday. Any last thoughts or comments? No, then we'll wrap up, and thanks everyone for your attention on this call.
Thanks, Jordan.
Thanks, Jordan. Take care.
Thanks, Jordan.